Thanks, Wonder Woman.
Poor Parasite.
Poor Parasite? That creature was a superhuman leech and a dangerous criminal.
Perhaps, Diana, but he was still a living being. And I hear a heartbeat.
Nothing will stop Kalathos now.
No mere man can defy Kalathos.
No man does. But Wonder Woman dares to do anything.
Exclusive video of the worst terror attack on England's soil, narrowly averted by the JLA. Rapid deployment of the League against the so-called Napalmettos contained the incident to a 4-block radius.
The amazing Amazon was dripping with the orange gunk as she wound up her lasso. President Lex Luthor spoke with the Trinity after the event, suggesting the attack clearly originated from Korak. Wonder Woman argued, "The device and the biochemical compound it animated bear all the traits of Professor Ivo's work, Mr. President. The League is searching for him as we speak, but he has no connections to Korak." Luthor thought otherwise. "Mr. President, are you proposing a preemptive strike without any solid proof that Korak is guilty of terrorism? International law and the UN Charter forbid unprovoked attack against a sovereign nation." Luthor insisted the League check out the Middle Eastern country and all but requested the assassination of President Barat. Wonder Woman was disgusted, for despite Barat being the most horrific of dictators, she refused to disregard international ethics. The League brought in Ivo, but the news still hyped the terrorist threat. Even Lois Lane fell for it, buying cases of olive oil in the event of another Napalmetto attack. The Trinity again were invited to a briefing at the Oval Office. Luthor was still pushing his agenda against Korak. Princess Diana once more noted,
"With respect, UN inspectors have found no evidence of WMDs in Korak, sir. We can't establish a clear connection between Ivo and Barat. There's no impending threat. America sets an example for the international community. If we attack without verifiable evidence, it sends a message to the world that diplomacy is a farce and peace has failed. Is that what America believes?"
Diana disappeared mid-sentence. Superman wondered where she went.
"Home. Don't worry, a bureaucratic snafu. Her diplomatic papers just needed to be reworked. Nothing to be alarmed about."
You see where this is going? Army Special Forces, disguised as Gotham PD, prevented protesters from reaching a cowardice rally until Batman busted some heads. He disappeared too. Superman heard protests from around the world against Luthor's march on Korak, but the president pleaded,
"They don't have all the information. They don't have our reports. I hear them, but I can't listen to them. It's a luxury I don't have right now."
Luthor continued to bang the patriotism drum and preach about his duty to protect the people. And where did Superman
get off questioning me?
Finally, Superman got so fed up he took his heat vision to the A in the JLA's meeting table, but too little too late, as Luthor killed him with kryptonite. The whole time, the president was harping on the familiar right-wing talking points heard incessantly during the U.S. invasion of Korak. Rhodesia would have appeared. It was all a dream of sorts, generated by a device of the Martian Manhunters employed without his supervision.
"Jean and I have used that machine before to help me unburden my mind of anxieties."
However, the big dumb Kryptonian needed a telepath to help guide his mental journey, and without one, Superman freaked out and wrecked stuff. Wonder Woman was present with the Atom and Batman, but only one got uncomfortably intimate with their consoling.
"It's all right, Superman. You're awake now. You're awake. Everything is all right."
Continuing on that thread, Diana was looking flirty in her already skimpy outfit a size too tight as she hung out in Clark's room, while he wore only a loosely closed robe.
"I called Jean. He said you owe him a new trans-consciousness articulator. He also said you were lucky. Forcing your conscious mind into the realm of your subconscious without a telepath to help maintain balance can be very dangerous."
Kal-El tried to defend his actions, but ultimately decided,
"Next time I'll just stick to confiding in Lois. She's my rock."
The only rock he seemed stuck to was Diana, hugging him with inappropriate body language. American Nightmare, from the September 2003 cover dated JLA number 83, was written by Joe Kelly and drawn by Chris Cross and Tom Wynn.
Welcome, fans of the Justice League universe. My name is Sam. This podcast focuses on the Warner Brothers movies that are part of the DC Films Justice League universe. Each episode of the podcast includes my analysis of a particular scene, and over time, I'll make my way through each movie. I love the depth of meaning in these films and all the subtle touches, and I love discussing them with other fans. I'm going to be moving scene by scene through the entire masterpiece that is Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. I will also try to find time to include episodes focused on Man of Steel, which is another movie that I greatly appreciate and love analyzing.
The Steel Fang and his gang were getting up to extra heavy duty hijinks in Gotham City, so Batman called Wonder Woman for help. Diana figured it was at least partially an excuse for the pair to talk about their developing feelings towards one another. After all, they'd shared a strangely passionate kiss before dying not so long ago. When a goon called out for them to get a room already, Diana asked Batman to be gentle as he tormented the mouthy dude into silence. Back at the JLA Watchtower on the Moon, Diana and Faith discussed the kind of love Dawn had for Manitou Raven to rebuild their life 3,000 years in the future. Faith turned out to be a romantic, but wasn't very good at love. Diana confessed,
"I've met Aphrodite. It sort of tarnished the romantic ideal."
Faith thought Diana might have had a thing with Superman, which made Diana laugh.
"Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Faith. No, Superman and I are very, very good friends, and that's all."
Wonder Woman had just heard that line so many times before, and Faith agreed that it was best not to dip your pen in the company ink. Nothing but trouble. While dismantling a giant training robot with an axe, Diana considered Batman's good and bad qualities. Finally, she decided it was time for an answer, and asked the Martian Manhunter if he could use his trans-consciousness articulator to work through the possibilities in a sort of virtual reality. And eternally young Diana spent her final days with her husband, the aged, crippled, sarcastic Bruce Wayne, on Paradise Island before he died. A ridiculous, fetishistic Batwoman severed a wife-beater's arm with her lasso while on patrol with a relatively nonchalant Batman. The Joker had just about murdered Batman, who pleaded with Wonder Woman not to let it push her over the line. Diana rushed the Clown Prince and took a face full of squirting flower acid. Then she grabbed the Joker by the face and dragged his head across a wall.
"My love is dead, and now so am I."
Despite petitioning her gods and literally going through hell, Diana was not allowed to bear Bruce Wayne's children. Still, she had saved his soul from darkness and made him a more optimistic and more flamboyant-looking hero. They had a life together, and it elevated Gotham City to a clean, ornate metropolis rivaling Superman's town. Diana came out of the trans-consciousness articulator with a smile on her face and Batman hovering over her. He had considered undergoing the same treatment, but
"I don't really want to see what's lurking around in my brain."
Simultaneously, they agreed not to progress to a romantic relationship.
"Bruce, it's possible. It's more than just possible that we could be wonderful together. There's equal potential for utter disaster. I love you as a lifelong friend, a confidant, an ally, but I'm not willing to risk that to see if there's more. Are you?"
They hugged and joked about how terrible things must have turned out in Diana's mind. Perchance, from the January 2004 cover dated JLA number 90, was by Joe Kelly, Chris Cross, and Tom Wynn. I tend to hate stories where Wonder Woman hooks up with either of the world's finest. I feel the relationship overshadows her, inflates the guys, and makes her seem like that chick in a group of male friends that ends up being passed around. On the other hand, I vastly prefer the less common Wonder Woman-Batman match to the incestuously boring and obvious Superman coupling. If Diana just wanted a nice guy with superpowers to settle down with, she wouldn't have to wait for Lois Lane to die. Diana spent all those years with Steve Trevor because he worked that balance between relatively capable, arrogant dick and vulnerable himbo in need of loving guidance and salvation. There's some parallels to Batman, but it occurs to me that Dick Nightwing Grayson is way more of a Steve. Thoughts? Also, while she sometimes pushes the boundaries of sexed up thickness, I rather like Chris Cross's take on Wonder Woman. She's about a full head taller than Faith and ripped as heck, but still undeniably feminine. That is damn tough to pull off. And there are definitely panels here where I get more of a Big Barda vibe, but it's still good looking stuff.
With his army of evil on the march, Bird Degaton appears to have time on his side. But when duty calls, they answer, bringing the fight for freedom to the front lines. They are the mystery men and women known as the Justice Society of America.
Hey there, my name is Al Girding, and I have a favor to ask. If you're a fan of the Justice Society of America or other DC Comics Heroes of the Golden Age, please listen to my new podcast, The All-Star Comics Review. Grab your reprints, DC Archive editions, or the original comics if you're lucky enough to own them, and let's explore the adventures of the JSA and other Golden Age greats. Follow along with the All-Star Comics Review podcast, now found on iTunes, allstarcomicsreview.blogspot.com, and Facebook.
Since this is already going to be a fairly brief episode, I figured I would go ahead and throw in a review of the new Cartoon Network series Justice League Action. The show began running in the UK and the US roughly a month apart late last year. And Justice League Action is essentially a continuation of Justice League Unlimited, where you have a core of iconic DC superheroes surrounded by volumes of lesser-known characters, offering them a showcase in mass media. Where this show differs from Justice League Unlimited is it's much shorter. Episodes only run about 15 minutes each. There are arcs, but they're mostly self-contained. The tone is much lighter and more kid-friendly, and in fact, there is a whimsy to it that better recalls Batman the Brave and the Bold, sometimes pushed to the comedic extremes of Teen Titans Go. And also, as evidenced by the name, it's very action-oriented. It's all about punching, 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 kicking, blasting. Characters are developed through dialogue in the midst of action, but nothing like introspection. I've seen all the first 10 episodes that have aired in the US, and I don't particularly like the show. The first episode, Classic Rock, which is also subtitled Shazam Slam Part 1 of 4, introduces the basic premise of the series. Batman is essentially the star of the show. He's in far more episodes than anybody else, and in a headlining role more often than not. He happens upon the wizard Shazam, who has been exiled from the Rock of Eternity and lost all of his powers. The two have to team up to save Billy Batson from the cause of Shazam's eviction, the returning Black Adam. The first short started out okay, but once they introduced Billy Batson slash Captain Marvel, I started having problems. In presenting Billy, they're trying to update him, make him seem more cool, more hip, more modern. And as a byproduct, he seems very obnoxious and very of a time that's not quite our own, given that animation takes a while to get going, and let's face it, most of the stuff is produced by middle-aged white dudes, so not the hippest crowd to begin with. And the show once again portrays Captain Atom as Billy Batson in a Superman body. So he speaks as a child. As a guy who's read Golden Age Captain Marvel stories, I'm not into that. I don't think that most people are into that. I think that's one of the reasons why Captain Marvel doesn't get traction, because nobody wants to see the show about a little kid in a grown-up's body acting still like a little kid, talking in that manner. It worked well in Justice League Unlimited because they used the innocence ability to contrast against the adulteration of Superman and the Justice League as a whole. But in this context, Captain Marvel just comes off as a goofus. The second story is called Power Outage. This one focuses mostly on Superman and Wonder Woman, and it's actually the point where I almost tapped out of the show entirely, because the story involves Parasite breaking out of prison by draining the life force from cockroaches so that he cumulatively gets enough power to actually get loose. At one point, he's essentially at the mercy of Superman and Wonder Woman is lectured on the sanctity of all human life by Superman. So clearly, this Wonder Woman bears no resemblance to anyone that I would accept. Once again, this is a hyper-aggressive warrior woman. They've got her in thigh-high boots with high heels, so she's weirdly fetishistic, especially because she has exposed thighs with a skirt that sort of points at her crotch. From the waist up, she's fairly recognizable as Wonder Woman. She's got the silver pointy gauntlets that started with John Byrne's redesign of the costume. She's got a big shield with WW on it. So for all you people that are tired of her looking like Captain America, here's more of that. They also give her a sword, which would be bad enough in my book, but it's also a hideous sword. It's this thing where it's got these Batman scallop things to them. It doesn't look like anything Greek. It doesn't look like anything Wonder Woman. Looks like what an adolescent would come up with if you try to tell them to like come up with a cool badass sword. And he comes up with this unfunctional thing that's really narrow in the middle, so it'd probably snap in half during a good sword fight. It looks like crap. But for me, probably the worst thing about the new Wonder Woman design is they give her this spiky hair that shoots off to the right. Again, that doesn't recall any version of Wonder Woman I've ever seen. It tries to make her all edgy, which is exactly what I want from Wonder Woman, right? No. And she has tons of attitude, and she's all about fighting with people. That's her defining characteristic, she wants to fight everybody. So not only does she have the worst aspects of the Timverse version of Wonder Woman, but also the worst aspects of their Hawk Woman, their Huntress. This tendency to communicate strong womanhood by being excessively aggressive, violent. It's so tiresome. Not what we need from a Wonder Woman. And it's just so lazy and such a shortcut to actually developing her character. She's fairly off-putting, so it's probably for the best that she also figures the least of the three in these cartoons by a wide margin. In the first story, the seven enemies of man are represented as Djinn, which is an old school way of just saying genie. They're evil genies, and one of the evil genies possesses Parasite and basically becomes the Martian Manhunter villain Furnace, who appeared in, appropriately enough, the Joe Kelly run of JLA. Besides looking like Furnace and having the same plan as Furnace to erupt a bunch of volcanoes to make it more to his liking as a fire being, they actually even bring in John Jones for the story. In fact, he plays a key role because this Djinn has Amazo's ability to not only match the Justice League's powers, but actually absorb them into himself and manifest them. So when he fights Martian Manhunter, he absorbs his weakness to fire and ends up with a raging case of supernatural fibromyalgia or something. It's an okay story with a super obvious ending. But besides hating how Wonder Woman's portrayed, I'm also not a big fan of their Martian Manhunter, nor the voice they use for that character. The third story is Night of the Bat, which we've seen a number of times. I think most recently in the Batman Brave and the Bold, where Batman gets possessed, turns evil, and has to fight the rest of the Justice League. Despite having no powers, he's fairly easily overcoming a lot of them. Booster Gold has some cute moments, nowhere near as cool as his spotlight back in Justice League Unlimited. It's an amusing little tangent in a story that's really about Green Arrow and the Justice League finally stopping Batman. The fourth and final part of Shazam Slam, a bait and switch, involves Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman battling the Djinns, Abnegazer, Wrath, and Nyorlath. because they're only willing to give you 2/3 of a bone if you're a Silver Age Just League fan. The heroes are in danger of having their powers stripped from them if their names are spoken by the Djinn. So they team up with John Constantine. And I hasten to add, it's not John Constantine, the Alan Moore character. It's John Constantine, spelled with a capital T-E-E-N. Even when he doesn't have a spell cast on him to speak in the most ridiculous version of Cockney, his English accent is sad. And he's basically just Dr. Fate in plain clothes. He runs around teleporting and shooting energy blasts from his hands. Why they felt the need to have John Constantine instead of going back to Fate like Unlimited did, I don't know why DC keeps trying to force John Constantine into their core continuity. The whole point of that character was that he was darker and more realistic, and you told mature stories with him. He doesn't belong in the core DC universe. He certainly doesn't belong in superhero teams, but he's more popular than Dr. Fate, so they're going to keep trying to force him into that role until he's not popular either. We also get Green Arrow and Plastic Man with a terrible voice. It's just like the worst Steve Urkel nerd voice ever. It's super annoying. Surely they could have gotten Tom Kenny back. Oh, and you also got Swamp Thing talking like, you know, a dude bro, basically. Doesn't sound like Dick Durock. Doesn't have any trouble speaking like the Bronze Age character. He's basically like a big green muscular Plastic Man. He sounds better than Plastic Man. I wish they just combined the voice actor with Plastic Man and left Swamp Thing alone. But anyhow, the two groups of heroes combine forces so that they're able to fend off the Djinn's powers, but not before the Djinn can bring back Black Adam, who's now even more powerful than ever, who fights the collected heroes, defeats them. But see, Batman, of course, always having to be smarter than everybody else, had left the battle earlier on to retrieve Captain Marvel. And despite them making it clear that Black Adam has upped his powers, it really comes down to just having Captain Marvel show up to help the other heroes, and everybody punches everybody else because pretty much everything on the show is solved by everybody punching everybody else. Until after all the punch face is done, Black Adam is the guy who falls down on the ground. Also, they introduce a new watchtower, which is built on top of the volcano to ensure that none of the Djinn ever try to bring Black Adam back, I guess, because they kind of already did the thing they were going to do at the volcano in the first place. Anyway, they set up this new watchtower, which is a translucent globe with random techno lighting inside of it. It's lame. It doesn't look like anything. I think the worst Justice League headquarters I can think of ever. I would take the bunker in Detroit over this thing. And it's kind of emblematic of the show. It's all style, no substance. It doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to live in a big hamster ball with rave lights in it? The fifth episode is Follow That Space Cab, which thankfully is one of the better episodes, mainly because they go full on goofy. It stars Space Cabby. You've got Mr. Mind in his classic incarnation with the radio talk box hanging around his neck. You've got Lobo. You've got Lobo's extremely obscure sidekick, Jonas, who you pretty much wouldn't know existed unless you read Lobo comics back in the 90s. And they're all having this wild and crazy adventure. It's fun. The only thing that sucks about it is Hawkman's redesign. That is lousy. And they spend the whole episode making fun of Hawkman anyway, and rightly so. He does sort of look like Foghorn Leghorn. But setting that aside, cool episode, nice break from the suckiness of most of the series to that point. And it's interesting because I think the series' high point so far is the next episode, Nuclear Family Values. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it was written by Paul Dini. In fact, they were both written by Paul Dini. And this is entirely a Firestorm showcase. And it's one of the best representations of the Nuclear Man I've ever seen, certainly in mass media. It's very faithful to Jerry Conway's original conception of the characters. They also bring in the goofball outsiders villains, the Nuclear Family, who are also portrayed very well. And even get Stephen Tobolowsky playing Professor Stein, which is great fun, especially if you're a fan of Tobolowsky's enormous oeuvre of character roles, probably most famous for Groundhog Day and Memento. Paul Dini also wrote the follow-up episode Zombie King, the Justice League Dark episode. It's got John Constantine, Zatanna, Swamp Thing, all battling Solomon Grundy and an army of zombies. This one I wasn't into. I actually was having trouble paying attention to it. I didn't watch these episodes in order and it was getting late. That might have been contributing factors. And I did like some of the bits they did with Zatanna, particularly how they have her using traditional stage magic gimmicks but amped up. Gives her a little bit more of a hook as the stage magician superhero, but I was still annoyed by Swamp Thing still essentially being Plastic Man in that one. The eighth episode is Galaxy Jest, in which Mongol kidnaps the Joker in an attempt to have him play comedian to his army of warriors who are on a giant starship instead of Warworld. And like, Mongol's whole thing in post-crisis has been being on Warworld, so why would you give him a starship? It's mostly about the Joker and Batman. Mongol is awful in his rendition. I'm not a fan of the way Mongol's been handled in recent decades, and here he's rendered monosyllabic. I know they did that with Young Justice. I don't think he spoke at all in Young Justice, and he was just a brute, or maybe I'm confusing him with Despero. Matter of fact, I pretty confident I'm confusing with Despero. So this is officially the worst version of Mongol ever, and it's another big punch out. It's not funny. The only good thing is you do have the classic Batman the Animated Series voice actors. Kevin Conroy is Batman, Mark Hamill is the Joker. But to some degree, that actually makes it worse because it makes you want to plug into the story, but the story is so pale in comparison to what these guys usually work with, the quality of the scripts they usually work with. Following that was Timeshare, which is a team up between Batman and the Jaime Reyes version of Blue Beetle against Kronos. And it makes, again, blatant reference to Batman the Animated Series, but in this instance, it's amusing. I'm not really won over by the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle in general, but especially in this episode. I didn't catch any of the episodes he appeared on Batman Brave and the Bold, so I don't know if he was better there. It's okay. I also didn't care for Kronos' voice. And given that the Atom doesn't really have much in the way of villains, I kind of want Kronos to have a decent voice. Plus, the obvious thing to do is to have him sound like Richard Nixon. They don't do that. The last of the episodes I've seen so far is Under a Red Sun. This one seemed to want to be an episode of Superman the Animated Series so hard. It's about Superman teaming up with Big Barda against Steppenwolf. It all takes place on alien worlds and involves Jack Kirby's creatures. This was one of the episodes I watched late in the night after I'd gone through most of the rest of the shows, so I didn't give this one much of a chance. I actually tuned out for good chunks of this one. It might have been better than I'm giving it credit for. It seemed like it was okay. I just didn't care at that point. So I guess what I'll do is I'll let another 10 episodes of the show queue up, and then I'll probably gripe about those too. But given that I've heard estimates of them having produced somewhere between 36 and 59 segments of this show, sight unseen, I'm not exactly holding out hope that things are going to get better. I'm just going to have to hope that there are more Paul Dini episodes in the waiting.
Welcome to Lasso of Truth,
a podcast about Wonder Woman.
My name is Juliet Kahn. I've been in comics professionally around 3 or 4 years now. As a critic, for most of that time, primarily for Comics Alliance and Publishers Weekly. So I do a lot of comic stuff, and at the end of the day, I'm just a big old fan of them.
I'm Elle Collins, and I am an assistant editor and writer at ComicsAlliance.com. I came up with the idea to start a Wonder Woman podcast because since I've been working full-time at Comics Alliance, I've sort of become the go-to Wonder Woman person. That really made me think more and more about Wonder Woman as a character. I hear people all the time saying that they don't really understand Wonder Woman, or they don't get her appeal, or they don't feel as positively towards her as they feel like they should.
I think Wonder Woman is in such a bizarre and unique place, and this is one of the reasons that I was totally game when you invited me to be a part of this podcast, in that she's in that place, like, at the center of two very weird forces that no other comics character, I feel, really is at the center of in quite the same way, where she matters to people. And she's become this cultural touchstone, and people have a lot of love and goodwill towards her. But at the same time, people don't know her, and people are keenly aware that they want to love her more than they actually do.
I'm looking forward to talking about more specific topics in the future. We have a Twitter, which is Lasso of Truth Pod.
And I'm always happy to stop and chat about Wonder Woman.
Wondrous words rang out from the 108 Sage, Allie Batts, Amzel Van Canterbury, Ange, Between the Pages, Blue Girl, Brian Kim, Brody's Kitchen, Captain Cupholder, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comic Reflections, Comics in the Golden Age, David Golding, DCU Movie Page, Diane Glover, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore at Indie Comics Fan, Marvel in the Bronze Age, Teal Productions, and Miskatonic, Eli, Emery Knilmes, Inigo Montoya, Felipe Alves de O, Firestorm Fan, Hulkling All Yeah, Jeffrey Brown, Joseph Crawford, Justice's First Dawn, Keith G. Baker, Madeline Clarkson, Mario Luther Lang, Martin Gray, Matches Baloney, Michael Chambel, Miltoner, Min, Nethead, Nicole, Nora Crest, Out of the Fridge Podcast, Pietro Blaximoff, Rad Adventures Podcast Network, Randy Caldwell, Reggie, Richard Field, Ricardo at RickyRicardo89, Rob at Speculum Fight, Ron BMOC Utley, Ronnie Casol, Ryan Daly, Silver and Gold Podcast, Siskoid, Slangwood Resists, Style Icon, Talking Wonder Woman, Tony Acero, Trekker Talk, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Warlord Worlds Podcast, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, We're All Monsters, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Yul R. Espinoza. Xenozoic Xenophiles wrote, "Time for the latest episode of Diana Prince Wonder Woman with Diablo Frank." Justice First Dawn tweeted, "We've got a new Wonder Woman coming through. Hola!" Satin Tides Podcast wrote, "Before you meet Nubia in Wonder Woman 77 meets the Bionic Woman, learn about her previous incarnations through this here podcast." Riley Daly wrote of the Nubia episode, "Never read these stories. So much potential in Nubia and great costumes." Ruth Sutherland wrote, "Great episode, Diablo Frank. Really enjoyed the summaries and all the history and backstory about a character I only vaguely remember. DC could have done so much more with the character. Definitely a missed opportunity. And wrote, my only interaction with Nubia is in that Supergirl comic book, so this was a great episode for me. Didn't realize all this about her history, although I'm sure I must have read about her in Who's Who. Thanks for covering. I wonder if she could have simply been folded into the Bound and McDoll Amazons in the post-crisis reboot. Well, and you couldn't read about her in Who's Who because she wasn't featured, although she is part of Zoom's Who, Zoom Yukinori's fan-produced addendum to Who's Who, which of course is featured on the Who's Who podcast, part of the Fire and Water Network. DC seemed really set on forgetting Nubia ever happened going into the 1980s, but she was brought back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I'm not sure which. To my recollection, not as a Bannon McDoll. She actually had a unique origin that set her, I believe, as part of the original Amazons on Themyscira as part of Perez's continuity. And it actually considered covering them as part of Black History Month. But A, one of the things I'm liking is that I have a bunch of other Nubia stories that we can look at. I actually recorded something a while back that I haven't released yet. I was recently visited by the Irredeemable Shag, and I had intended to get him to do a voice for this particular story and then completely forgot all about it, so I guess we're going to have to do it without him. But that one will also feature Nubia, and the fact is I have major issues with Black History Month because I feel like we should acknowledge Black history all year round. But the fact is, white guys like me sometimes need to be reminded to make a point of doing something for Black history. So I'm glad I got the one out in February, but I really want to continue to have stuff with Nubia throughout the year. And thankfully, in stories like the upcoming Wonder Woman Meets Bionic Woman, we'll have an opportunity to be reintroduced to Nubia in brand new stories. And the classic Nubia that I spoke of in that episode. The post-crisis, post-Zero Hour, pre-New 52 Nubia is very different from the one we met in the 1970s. To be honest, I seriously considered this episode being about that character. And then I went and flipped through her appearances and was reminded that those are some of the worst stories from a particularly bad period of Wonder Woman series. And I just didn't really want to. So we're definitely going to get back to that. And I'm sure we'll get back to it within this year. But I'm not in a big rush. Finally, Martin Gray wrote, this should be fun. That heartless archenemy of evil Nubia. Well, that makes no sense. Surely someone who hates evil isn't heartless. Mars All. I could see that. The worst bit of any of these stories was that Dinah was reminded of someone by her black roommate because all black people look the same. Gee, did her Asian UN roomie remind her of Egg Foo? Hippolyta messing with Dinah's head was unforgivably selfish. It took years before any writer addressed that, but I'm glad they finally did. Oh, and an episode chock full of hilarious voices, the Amazon chorus was the best thing ever. Thank you, Martin, and I did notice you spelled that C-H-O-C chock full. I see what you did there. Wonder Woman is the copyright of DC Comics Entertainment. This is a non-profit fan-produced podcast. No infringement of any copyrights are intended. And where copyrighted material appears, it is believed protected under fair use. If you enjoy the show, please feel free to leave a comment on the Diana Prince is the New Wonder Woman blog, the Rolled Spine podcast blog. Write to me at emailofdiabolu@yahoo.com, featuring two underscores. Or just hit me up on Twitter @CommanderBlanks or @RolledSpine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful week.